From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, how should film schools and nonprofits deal with gifts from donors accused of sexual assault and harassment? Then documentary filmmaker Morgan Neville listens in on producer Rick Rubin at Shangri-La, his Malibu recording studio.
He's not somebody who's been that used to having cameras around, so Rick rarely wears shoes. We decided we shouldn't wear shoes either, you know, so we could creep around the house and we could be as discreet as possible.
And the Broad Museum's Soul of a Nation is a compelling look at two decades of work by Black artists. All that coming up on The Frame. Hollywood is approaching 2 years since the Harvey Weinstein story broke. And while the entertainment industry is still far from equality and free of predators, the powerful Me Too and Time's Up movements have swept out heavyweights such as Weinstein and former CBS head Les Moonves following several sexual harassment allegations. But pretty much every powerful person in Hollywood is also a regular donor to charity. And consequently, organizations have been forced to consider what to do with gifts from disgraced donors. I called up Rebecca Sun, who wrote about all this for The Hollywood Reporter, and she began by explaining how philanthropic groups are in a unique position when a Me Too scandal surfaces.
The world of philanthropy is a little different from, you know, when we talk about, well, do companies have a right to fire these people or ask them to resign? It's different from employment. You know, this is, in the purest sense of the word, a completely voluntary endeavor. Nobody was obligated to give. Nobody was obligated to receive. And so I think that it's okay if these nonprofits, particularly those that really can't afford to take a reputational hit, they operate under much slimmer margins, and it's just not worth the potential blowback if they continue to be associated with somebody who, regardless of what the law says, the public has already decided that their money is dirty.
Well, and the other issue that raises, and this is part of the conversation about memorials for Civil War generals, is that if you are, say, an African-American person and you see a statue that was erected probably in the 20th century to commemorate a Confederate soldier, it is a reminder of what happened to oppress you. And I wonder if that's part of the math as well, that if you are a woman generally and you see a building that is named after somebody who's been accused of sexual harassment, it obviously would make you really uncomfortable. Is that part of the factor here?
Certainly. I think that there is a sensitivity towards how this feels to survivors of a similar crime, you know, or bad behavior. There's a sensitivity towards how that feels. And there's also, I think, a desire for nonprofits not to feel like they're being used to absolve donors. For example, when Harvey Weinstein, when the accusations against him were first made in October 2017, you know, he had this sort of long statement declaring that he was intending to donate to support female filmmakers at USC. Now, USC rejected that donation, and in part, it's sort of like, well, we don't really want to be used to make you seem more innocent, as if, you know, this absolves you from whatever you've been accused of. And so I think that they just don't want to be used as pawns.
Right. But there's an opposite side to that argument, and that is that some people might see it as kind of blood money, but other people might say there is a need here. And if we're trying to make progress, maybe we should think about accepting that money and turning it into something positive.
So one side says this is blood money, this is tainted, particularly if, as I spoke to one philosopher, Ted Lechterman, who specifically studies the ethics of giving, where he says, well, if this money was ill-gotten, then this money is tainted and it's not yours to use. The other side is, you know, something like Rutgers University, which did accept a donation from Harvey Weinstein. You could say it was ironic. It went towards the Gloria Steinem Endowed Chair for Feminist and Media Studies. It was in an honor of Harvey's mother that he gave that gift. And they said, we're going to use this money to help promote the causes of women. And so that's what these philanthropic organizations are weighing out.
We're talking with Rebecca Sun at The Hollywood Reporter. You also quote Daniel Borchoff, who's the president of the watchdog nonprofit Charity Watch, and he says, quote, philanthropy has a long history of turning bad money into good deeds. You have this ethical trade-off. Do you want children not to get adequate health care because you want to take the moral high ground. And I'm wondering if that's part of what these organizations are really struggling with. Do they think that there is a benefit that they can do, even if there's a downside to public pressure or media scrutiny about accepting the money?
Particularly those that work with people who are very, very vulnerable, sick children, survivors of domestic violence, things like that, where every cent really, really counts. You know, I've talked to a lot of these philanthropy experts who sort of said, nothing is really pure in this world. Everybody is touched in some way by both good and bad. It is possible to be both a genuine believer in good causes and to have done bad things. And somebody who perhaps is guilty of sexual misconduct can be a great environmentalist. So that's where this classic ethical dilemma comes in, which is the need greater than the source of these funds? And I don't think that there's necessarily an objective right or wrong. It's sort of at the end of the day, this mix of factors, what's going to outweigh the other?
So if they remove the person's name from a building or a wing, is there a problem with they might be forced to give the money back? Does this trigger a series of things that actually might cost them money?
Right. It's a little bit different from selling naming rights to a stadium or something like that, where it's very clearly stipulated for X amount of money, I will put your name, you know, on this building. Certainly for gifts, there is an understanding there. You know, that was very clearly, you know, a part of like, I'd like to, you know, build this library and you can name it after me. I think that practically speaking, in most cases where the circumstances under which somebody's name is being removed, the donor's usually dealing with a lot more than that. They're not really going to go after the organization to say, well, now I want my money back. In some cases, the money has long been spent. A lot of nonprofits, you know, they're not going to keep these giant donations in their coffers for long. So we had some organizations like the Clinton Foundation that said, we can't give back Harvey Weinstein's money. He gave it to us years ago. There's other organizations for whom to give back a sizable gift would put them in the red. They operate under too slim of a margin to be able to easily do that.
Rebecca Sun is a senior reporter at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up on The Frame, Rick Rubin is one of the most successful yet enigmatic record producers of all time. A new docuseries uncovers some of what makes him tick. Last year, Morgan Neville made the Mr. Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor? Now he turns his eye on another legendary figure, the enigmatic record producer, Rick Rubin. Shangri-La is a four-part look at how Rubin went from launching the Beastie Boys to producing countless hits for artists like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Adele, and Jay-Z. For Neville, understanding Rubin also means understanding the history and mythology of his Malibu recording studio, Shangri-La. It was originally built for Bob Dylan and the band in 1976. Everyone from Eric Clapton to Bonnie Raitt recorded there, and since Rubin took it over, it's only achieved more mystery and fame. Neville and I sat down recently, and we began with his first meeting with Rubin.
Rick and I ended up talking about Orson Welles and Magic and mid-60s John Frankenheimer movies and just went off for like 90 minutes. We didn't talk about music, though. That's the thing. And I think because of that, he kind of responded well. And what ensued from there was kind of an ongoing conversation we've had, the result of which is this TV series, you know, which is not conventional by any stretch. But what it becomes and the things we agreed about were that we were interested in creative process. And if somebody could come away from watching this show with an idea of what it's like to be produced by Rick, then we've succeeded.
It is nice up there.
It sounds way better. Ooh. Do you want to try? You want to try the hook in falsetto and see how it feels?
Even if it hurts you. Yeah.
Just see how that feels.
And a lot of that is carried out through the film. There are overheard conversations with people like Tyler, the Creator, LL Cool J, Chuck D, Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers, that you are kind of listening in as they are talking. At a certain point, I'd assume you kind of disappear from the process. They forget about you.
They do. It was part of the process for Rick, too, because he's not somebody who's been that used to having cameras around, which is unusual for somebody as well known. But he really has kept a very low profile. And I think part of it was us figuring out how to disappear. you know, as you see in the show, Rick rarely wears shoes. We decided we shouldn't wear shoes either, you know, so we could creep around the house and we could be as kind of indiscreet, you know, as discreet as possible.
Well, and also he doesn't want any distractions for the artists who are recording there. So there's no artwork on the walls. The furniture is very bare. It is in many ways a little bit like the monastery in Shangri-La, that it is he's trying to create a spiritual place for artists without the distractions of the material world.
You can't come here and not feel so lucky to be able to be here. Like, the way this place just flows, it's kind of uplifting you, trying to get the best out of you.
What I think the studio really is, and this is what I came to realize as we were making it, is kind of a statement as to what he aspires to. And he says this in the show, which is to disappear. You know, that if he says this in the first episode, and I've thought a lot about this, that he said, my dream is to produce an artist without ever speaking to them or meeting them and have them do their best work. And I'm not there yet. But I think his studio is him trying to do that.
There's a lot of mythology surrounding Rick Rubin. I want to play a clip, I think it's from the second episode, of how he himself describes his own mythology.
There's one where people think I'm arrogant because I'm pretty quiet. There's a mythology that I don't do anything because I lay down when I work. Because I have a beard and was photographed often with sunglasses, people always assumed I was on drugs. I've heard that everything I touch turns to gold, both in terms of music and in terms of people. It's funny that my mind went to the worst ones first.
So it seems like there's two things that almost are competing, that you want to demythologize Rick Rubin, but in the process, you almost end up mythologizing him.
Absolutely. But it gets into the sweet spot of what I think Rick's creative engine is, which is when you lose the definition of what's possible or not possible, what's real or not real, that's where Rick's sweet spot is. Many of his obsessions throughout life, of which we go into great detail, things like wrestling, personifies this idea of not knowing and ultimately not caring exactly what's real and what's not real.
We're talking with Morgan Neville about his Showtime documentary series, Shangri-La. There is a segment in the second episode that's largely about his beginning as a producer, and it happens in his dorm room at NYU, where Def Jam starts. I want to play a clip where he talks about creating a sound that wasn't there before in hip-hop.
What I heard at the club was very different than those one or two rap records that were coming out a week. It's like the club was drum machines, break beats, and rappers. Live hip-hop. But none of the records sounded like that. The records were all like produced, whereas the club was grimy. And almost like documentary style, I wanted to make a record that sounded like the club.
So much of his producing seems almost anthropological, that he's going out and opening himself to ideas by watching and listening to other people. Is that part of what you took away from?
Absolutely. I mean, I think he even says in a later episode that fundamentally I'm a researcher, which I thought was so interesting, that, you know, he's somebody who just wants more information, more data. You know, he would go work on a world music album or a classical, avant-garde classical, you know, album. The stuff he would send me wasn't the latest, you know, hip hop artist. It was, you know, underground European avant-garde classical music that he was listening to, or a podcast he was listening to. So I think it was really about trying to stay as open and curious as you can always be and try to ignore what the outside world tells you you should be doing. And I think his role as a producer is to try and impart those same lessons to each and every artist he works with.
You employ some unusual strategies to tell this story, primarily using actors to play Rick Rubin at certain points in his life, including a very young actor who wears a Rick Rubin beard. There's a marionette. There's a talking rabbit. There's other little devices that you use.
Of course there's a talking rabbit.
There's a restaging of a movie that Rick Rubin was in. When you were thinking about all of those different strategies, what was driving them? Was there a unifying theme about those tactics that you employed to tell the story?
I feel like a strategy I've used throughout my career is really letting the subject help dictate the way I tell the story. You know, doing a film about Fred Rogers, I made a very simple and deep and deliberate film. Making a film about Rick, I felt like I had this license. And it's not just me, my co-director, I should say, Jeff Malmberg and I, you know, we strategized about this and said, you know, how are we going to tell this story in a way as unconventional as Rick is? And if you look at Rick throughout his life, he's had these phases where you almost look at him now and say, he doesn't even seem like the same person he was there. And he's had a number of these stages. So we just thought, well, we will have these different representations of Rick at these different stages. And each new Rick emerges in each episode. And it was a really interesting challenge, but it actually became kind of our key to unlocking how to tell the story.
Rick Rubin has on his list of artists that he's worked with an incredibly diverse slate. Beastie Boys, heavy metal bands like Slayer, Red Hot Chili Peppers. Do you think there's a unifying idea about the kinds of artists he likes to work with and what he brings to the process?
It's interesting. And I talked to Rick a fair amount about this, that when I was a younger man, I made a film about Sam Phillips. Many, many years ago, maybe 20 years ago, the legendary Memphis producer that discovered Elvis Presley, but not just Elvis, Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, Howlin' Wolf, B.B. King, you know, all these great musicians. And what Sam believed, which I think is the same thing that Rick believes, is I just want to hear something I haven't heard before. And I think part of it is taste. Like Rick says, all I have is taste. All I have is my gut. You know, that's what I have to listen to.
And yet he's not trained at all as a musician. He understands music, but he never studied it.
But also, and you see it in the film, I think Rick's whole thing has always been about trying to get somebody's true self out. I mean, if you even look at the credit he took on the LL Cool J album, his first album, when he was a very young man, the credit on the record is reduced by Rick Rubin.
And
Reduced by. I think his entire method as a producer is to get to the essence of who an artist is.
The name Shangri-La comes from the James Hilton novel Lost Horizons, which was turned into a film by Frank Capra. And it's this Tibetan utopia. And this utopia of Rick Rubin's is more or less recreated in Malibu. But Malibu also has brush fires.
Dario, kick on all the sprinklers.
Dario, we can leave them on.
Leave the water on.
Feels like that's important to the film, that this idea of paradise confronting the real world.
You know, Rick, I think, is uniquely philosophically positioned to deal with something like that. I mean, I think he understands kind of the horror of it, but he also looks at it philosophically. Horrible things bring with them opportunities or change, and change is always a good thing for Rick. I mean, it's not a secret to say his house burnt down in the fire. And when asked about it, he just talked about the trees and how sad he was that those old trees were gone.
Yeah, the house can be rebuilt. The trees are gone forever.
Yeah.
Morgan Neville's new documentary is called Shangri-La. Morgan, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, John.
Shangri-La premieres on Showtime on July 12th. Coming up on The Frame, the Broad Museum exhibition, Soul of a Nation, which chronicles a slice of the Black experience. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Soul of a Nation is a wide-ranging exhibition at the Broad Museum that features work from 1963 to 1983 by more than 60 Black artists. The Frame contributor Linnell George says the show is a bold and vibrant exaltation of presence and passion. Here's her take on the exhibition.
There's a question I grew up hearing here on the West Coast. It feels like casual inquiry. But it's code among Black folk, particularly those from or with roots in the American South. Who's your people? It's shorthand, a way to quickly acquire context across time and space. The question acknowledges the diaspora, the many lives and souls it took to get here, to get to us. That question circled through me as I made my way through the deeply compelling exhibition, Soul of a Nation. As I walked through the galleries, I couldn't separate the art from the music that was made during this era, a soundtrack to the many questions that explore and help define the the Black experience.
If you had a choice of colors,
who are our people? What are we connected by? Geography and history? Revolution and resiliency? Soul of a Nation explores the expansive and complex territory of self-making and how artists strategize a plan more far-reaching than survival, one that articulates pride and knowledge of self. The exhibition presents work over two explosive decades, 1963 to 1983, by more than 60 Black artists. The Broad Museum showcases an authoritative LA presence, rep by key figures Betty Saar, Charles White, John Otterbridge, and David Hammons, among others. Stepping inside the first gallery triggered something deep, that highly charged sensation you might experience when you recognize something or someone familiar in an unexpected place, a profile, an intonation, a gesture. The imagery, the raised fists, the halo of afros, the red, black, and green of pride and liberation, yes, that, but also a piece of yourself in the story, where you entered and found your voice, your own footing. The first pin in the map is 1963, Harlem, and the formation of the Spiral Collective, a group of artists based in New York, who were grappling with the notion of what it meant to make Black art during the heat of the Civil Rights Movement. They asked a question that was only by degrees rhetorical. Is there a Negro image? The group, which first met in Romare Bearden's Harlem studio, were named such by the artist Hale Woodruff because he saw the spiral as a metaphor, moving outward, embracing all directions, yet continuing forward. Norman Lewis's Black and White Expressionist canvases are paired with Bearden's loose and intimate collages that echo busy street scenes or rural homesteads. There is inherent power in the juxtapositions. Side by side, like collage, as Bearden asserted, assemblage itself forced a variety of contrary images into one unified expression.
What you look like when you're doing what you're doing is what you're doing when you're doing what you look like you're doing. Express yourself.
Activism energized the streets, redrew lines, and urgently threaded through the Black arts community. Upending the status quo on the West Coast found voice in 1965's Watts Rebellion, and in the work of Melvin Edwards, Daniel LaRue Johnson, John Otterbridge, Noah Purifoy, John T. Riddle, and Betty Saar. Some of them collected wreckage from the streets and turned broken glass, twisted metal, and other found objects into trenchant works of art. What was deemed as trash or ruin was transformed. The gaze of the Black artist determined what was valuable. The powerful and varied prism of Black subjectivity, naming and defining oneself, is deeply freeing and the most compelling gift of this exhibition. Betty Saar observed that artists had begun to look beyond crisis and find cures through rituals, totems, altars, observances. As she reflected, they've got over the violent part and have become more introspective. That's the gesture or soul that forges connection. Beaufort Delaney's portrait of James Baldwin offers an alternative view of the writer, depicted not with the worry of the world etched on his face, but rather in a moment you might imagine him seated in the restorative glow of love from friends and found family. It's much in the same way that photographer Roy De Caraba's gradient grays and murky half-light force viewers to adjust themselves to truly see, not just slow down, but stop. Lean in close and examine the image to see humanity. Lorraine O'Grady's series of images, Art Is, in a lighthearted way, goes to the very heart of this matter. Do we simply survive, or do we thrive? In 1983, under an alter ego, she entered a float in Harlem's African American Day Parade. She hired 15 dancers to carry large, gilded frames into the crowds. They'd raise the frame and make street portraits. In so doing, the work answers its own open-ended question. We are.
Take it from me, someday we'll all be free.
Soul of a Nation is a bold and vibrant exaltation of presence and passion, unifying many disparate approaches and perspectives into vivid visual language. There's something striking about this show, given the backdrop of the current looping news cycle, spiking gun violence and hate crimes, retrograde race relations. This doesn't feel like a retrospective, but rather a collection of much-needed tools and templates for how we, as a people, collectively, can shape destiny, find community and pride, and most important, make beauty out of wreckage. For The Frame, I'm Linnell George.
Soul of a Nation is at the Broad Museum in downtown LA through September 1st. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn in the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll be back here tomorrow.